couple of minutes behind time. I'm not going to ask for people to shorten their presentations. I'll ask for you all to be prepared to be here about 5 minutes beyond time. So, thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me? Thank you all for being here. I really feel blessed to be a part of this panel. We've had some really great presentations already so far today. And I want to thank Dr. Rosario for doing a great job of giving an overview of smoking in the lesbian, gay, and bisexual community. So I don't have to go into the background as much. And in some ways, I think my presentation is going to complement hers, although I sort of wish I had gone first, except for the great overview, because we're sort of taking a step back to look at patterns of smoking development across adolescence and young adulthood. And it would have made sense for me to give the kind of patterns that we see in the population, and then for Dr. Rosario to come and try to explain what may be going on or to get in more detail. Before I begin, I definitely would like to acknowledge my collaborators on this project, Heejin Jun, who's here today. Thank you for coming to support me. And Bryn Austin, who's back in Boston, and Lindsay Frazier, who's back in Boston. I'd also like to thank the participants of the Growing Up Today study. Without their involvement over the past 12 years in this work, you would not be seeing the data that I'm presenting today, so their participation is the most critical. Also, I have no financial relationships to disclose. So we all know that minority sexual orientation youth are more likely to smoke cigarettes. A number of studies have shown this, and I'm, for the purposes of today's presentation, I'm going to use the term minority sexual orientation frequently rather than a lesbian, gay, or bisexual, because in our sample we have a wider range of sexual orientation. So for me, minority sexual orientation youth are individuals who identify as lesbian, gay, or bisexual, or who have sexual attractions or romantic relationships with individuals of the same sex. Regardless of which dimension of sexual orientation is assessed, minority sexual orientation youth are at higher risk for cigarette smoking than their heterosexual peers. Most of the studies that we've seen that have looked at differences by sexual orientation across a range of sexual orientations have been cross-sectional. Few studies have been able to track adolescence over time into young adulthood using multiple follow-up assessments in order to examine how sexual orientation may be related to different longitudinal patterns of smoking development. And also, we don't understand all the mechanisms or all the reasons why minority sexual orientation youth are more likely to smoke cigarettes, and the extent that psychological factors such as depressive distress or anxiety may play a role in contributing to these disparities is not fully understood. So today I'm going to present some findings from a large longitudinal cohort study of adolescents that were followed into young adulthood using information gathered from study participants for over 10 years. We compare longitudinal trajectories of tobacco smoking among youth who report their sexual orientation as completely heterosexual, mostly heterosexual, bisexual, or lesbian or gay. I'll also discuss some public health implications of these findings and briefly touch upon some future analyses that our group is undertaking in order to understand the role of depressive distress and other factors such as self-esteem in contributing to the disparities in tobacco smoking. So I'm not sure how many of you have seen my research team present about the Growing Up Today study, so I'm gonna give some information about the study, so it'll help you place these findings into context. The data for the study come from a national longitudinal cohort study of 16,882 adolescents recruited across the United States. It began in 1996 when participants were between the ages of 9 to 14 years. And recruitment actually occurred through their mothers, because their mothers are participants of the Nurses' Health Study 2, which is a longitudinal cohort study of more than 100,000 nurses that began in 1989. Reflecting the ethnic racial composition of the Nurses' Health Study 2 participants, the vast majority of GUTS participants are white. So keep that in mind as you see the findings. Since the beginning of the study, participants have completed self-administered questionnaires every year or every other year. So the analysis sample that I'm presenting on today are participants who gave information on their frequency of smoking cigarettes in the past year, as well as their sexual orientation, on at least one follow-up assessment between 1997 and 2005. It's a sample that includes about 8,000 females and 6,000 males. It's 83% of the original cohort. And the age range for these participants span between 12 and 25 years. So the sexual orientation measure included on GUTS comes from an adolescent health survey, which was conducted in the late 80s from Minnesota. It's a question that's since been used successfully on a number of adolescent health studies, including the most recent, the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health. And a version of this question, it asks participants, which one of the following best describes your feelings, with response options that range from completely heterosexual to completely homosexual. So the question was included in GUTS on Wave 1999 through 2005. And for this analysis, we're using a hierarchical coding strategy, which classified respondents who reported that they were mostly or completely homosexual down here as lesbian or gay. Participants who reported that they were bisexual but not mostly or completely homosexual on any of the waves were classified as bisexual. Participants who reported that they were mostly heterosexual but not bisexual or mostly or completely homosexual on any wave were classified as mostly heterosexual. And then participants who only said they were completely heterosexual on any of the survey waves were classified as completely heterosexual. This was a way to kind of account for the variability across time in a succinct way, so I can present some interesting findings. The next slide shows the distribution of sexual orientation in GUTS using the hierarchical coding strategy that I just described. As you can see, among males, about 88% said they were completely heterosexual on all waves. About 7% said they were mostly heterosexual, about 1% said they were bisexual, and about 2% said they were gay. There are a few number of participants that didn't answer the question at all throughout the study or said they were unsure. And I'm not going to present data on them because it's not very interesting. So in this talk, I'm trying to stick to the interesting stuff. So among females, fewer actually identified only as completely heterosexual. More certainly, almost 16% at some point in the survey said they were mostly heterosexual, about 3% bisexual, and about 1% lesbian. So also, this hierarchical coding strategy was pretty strongly correlated with their last report of sexual orientation in 2005. So our outcome measure, frequency of smoking cigarettes in the past year, was assessed between 1997 and 2005. Participants who reported that they had smoked cigarettes in the past year were asked, when you're smoking, how often do you smoke? Response options included don't smoke, less than once a month, monthly or less than once a week, weekly or 1 to 5 days per week, and daily or almost every day. So wave of response was converted into age of response in order to estimate smoking across age, which is the important developmental unit of analysis. In order to decrease missingness, ages were collapsed into the following categories that are shown on the slide. And if there was more than one response from a participant in any age category, those responses were averaged. So we used M+ software to conduct general growth mixture modeling for a continuous outcome in order to estimate the developmental trajectories of cigarette smoking in the GUTS cohort. The figure on the slide depicts the growth mixture model that was used to estimate the smoking trajectories. Just very briefly, there's a lot of literature out there on this statistical method, so if you want more information, you can go and read about it. But general growth mixture modeling is a latent variable statistical analysis strategy that combines factor analysis and latent class analysis. Factor analysis is used to estimate the intercept and slope latent growth factors from the smoking outcome measures here. And then latent class analysis is used to classify individuals into distinct trajectory groups who share a similar pattern of smoking over time. That's the latent classes down here. Thus, we were able to estimate the relationship of sexual orientation to the smoking trajectories. So this slide shows the smoking trajectories that were estimated from the model. Model fit indices indicated that a six-class model was the best fit for the data, which suggests that there are six distinct developmental trajectories of smoking in GUTS. So the pink line you see at the bottom, where's my cursor? Here we go. Of the graph, it shows the non-smoking referent group, and about 77% of the cohort are non-smokers throughout adolescence and young adulthood. The maroon line that you see up at the top here, it shows a group of youth who are frequent smokers right in the beginning by age 12 or 13, and then they continue to be frequent smokers throughout into young adulthood, which is about 2% of the cohort. The black diagonal line that you see here represents a group who start out as non-smokers in early adolescence and become frequent smokers by young adulthood, and that's about 11% of the cohort. So then we also have this transient smoking group. It's the upside down U-shaped blue line, which shows that about 4.5% of the participants are non-smokers in the beginning, and then they become frequent smokers by age 16 or 17, but then by the time they reach young adulthood, they're not smoking anymore. And then finally, there are two groups in the middle here, which are sort of like the moderate smoking group. I guess you'd consider them the chippers, and that's about 5.4% of the cohort. So this slide shows the relationship of sexual orientation to the smoking trajectories. As you can see, GUTS participants who reported a minority sexual orientation, whether it be mostly heterosexual, bisexual, or lesbian gay, had a greater odds of being in the moderate smoking trajectory group, the transient smoking trajectory group, the low to high smoking trajectory group, as well as the always high smoking trajectory group. And in most instances, these differences were statistically significant. For the next two slides, I'm going to focus in on sexual orientation differences for males and females separately. As you can see here over on the left of the slide, minority sexual orientation males and females are less likely to be in the non-smoking trajectory. Among males, about 79% of completely heterosexuals are classified as never smokers, compared to 66% of mostly heterosexuals, 61% of bisexuals, 63% of gay males. And then among females, about 83% of completely heterosexuals are never smokers, compared to 65% of mostly heterosexuals and 58% of lesbians. Alarmingly, less than half, or only 49% of bisexual females, were never smokers during adolescence and young adulthood. And the graph on the right shows the transient use group distributions by gender. So this slide shows the sexual orientation distribution for the low to high use group and the always high use group. If you look at the graph on the left, you'll see that about 11% of completely heterosexual males are classified into the low to high use group, compared to 18% of mostly heterosexual males, 20% of bisexual males, 23% of gay males. Among females, the patterns that you see are pretty similar. And then the bar graph on the right shows the differences for the always high youth group. We see that there are bigger differences for females than males, and bisexual females, approximately 8% are in that group. So one additional piece of information that I want to point out is that minority sexual orientation in the model was actually positively associated with both the intercept and the slope growth factors. And this actually means that on average, within each class, the starting level of frequency of smoking and the rate of growth of frequency of smoking is actually higher for minority sexual orientation youth compared to heterosexual youth. So even within each class, they're worse off. If that makes sense to people. So in conclusion, I've presented some pretty strong evidence here that shows that minority sexual orientation is strongly related to greater risk of being in a high smoking trajectory group. By young adulthood, 20% of mostly heterosexual males, 24% of bisexual males, 24% of gay males are frequent smokers. Among females, it's 20% of mostly heterosexuals, 28% of bisexuals, 26% of lesbians are frequent smokers by young adulthood. And alarmingly, we have a pretty significant group of minority sexual orientation females that begin smoking frequently by age 12 to 13, and the burden, the morbidity burden related to smoking for this group is likely to be very high, with increased risk for asthma and other, you know, health problems related to smoking. So it's important to place these findings in the context of the strengths and limitations of the study, things we do at APHA. Because GUTS is mostly white, findings may not be applicable to other racial ethnic groups. However, GUTS is a large cohort. Responses from 83% of the sample are included in the analysis. Although GUTS is not representative, participants were not enrolled on the basis of their sexual orientation, which may a strategy which may reduce generalizability. And then finally, participants were followed for considerably long time with multiple assessments. Most of them had between 4 and 6 assessments of smoking over time. So clearly, these data show that there's an urgent need for the public health profession to act immediately to prevent and reduce cigarette smoking among minority sexual orientation youth. I think even though we don't know all the reasons why these youth are smoking, and it may be a coping strategy that we learned is not that effective, I think we need to start developing interventions and testing them out before we know all the information out there. And I think these interventions definitely need to start early. So I just wanted to end my talk by sharing some work that we're currently undertaking using growth mixture modeling to try to understand the role of depressive distress and other factors, such as self-esteem, in contributing to sexual orientation differences in the smoking trajectories. Unfortunately, time constraints don't let me present this data in more detail because I wanted to show you the really rich and interesting smoking trajectories that we found. However, with respects to findings related to depressive distress, we are finding that minority sexual orientation youth in GUTS are more likely to be in a higher depressive symptoms trajectory. We're able to track their depressive symptoms over time. And in addition, these higher depressive symptoms trajectories are positively associated with higher frequency of smoking trajectories. And so depressive distress in GUTS does appear to be related to the greater risk of becoming a frequent smoker among the minority sexual orientation youth in GUTS. And hopefully we'll be able to present these findings in greater detail in the future.
Time for one question.
Sexual orientation categories.
Yes.
And is there any relationship between changing sexual orientation categories and starting smoking or being in different categories?
Fantastic question. We're working with a collaborator at the School of Public Health, in Harvard School of Public Health and Biostatistics. He's a graduate student, and he's doing modeling of these change over time. So we're able to we're kind of trying to figure out which youth have a greater mobility of changing their sexual orientation over time. And once that research gets ironed out, we're going to link it with these smoking trajectories to see if there's a difference. So, good. In this model, we just controlled for gender, right? The thing about guts, which is important to understand, is that there aren't a lot of confounders that you would see as much in a normal, in a more representative sample, because they're all children of nurses. They're primarily white. They're primarily middle-class individuals. So a lot of the traditional confounders that you would see in a representative sample don't show up so much in guts. But I do definitely want to look at not so much confounders, but factors that may explain these differences. And one is peer smoking use, and the other is family use. So in the future, definitely we're going to look at these factors and how they may contribute. I do know that controlling for family use doesn't attenuate these differences at all. Peer use plays a big role. One of the moderate use groups, yeah. That's a good question. These methods are definitely new for me, and I started by building. It estimates growth mixture modeling for a continuous outcome. You can see that this variable is an ordinal, and not continuous. So there. Which is often done with this strategy, and it's not necessarily a violation of the model per se, but it's not completely normally distributed, and so with this outcome variable, I started building the model. I looked at a 2-class model, a 3-class model, a 4-class model, a 5-class model, a 6-class model, a 7-class model, an 8-class model, and then within the literature, there's different fit indices, and so I looked at the different fit indices to see which best explained the data, and the 6-class model did. And I don't know if you know anything. Do you know anything about this method? Okay. I want to go down. No. So this actually shows some fit indices for the model, and the one thing to see is the entropy is very high for a lot of M+ models. Muthan folks will say that an entropy of 0.7 or above is pretty good, and this has a very high entropy, which means it does capture the variation pretty well that's going on. I can't say that I'm 100% confident that this is the final model that you'll see in a publication, because I do need to do some additional testing, but it's pretty good.
Other. I'm thinking about the group that is hyperbolic.
Right.
Others have a more shallow slope.
Yep.
Have you thought about what it is that may distinguish these groups from each other?
In terms of what?
I don't know. fact, those groups are real, which I think sort of goes to the question that this young man was asking. What might distinguish them?
That's a good question. That's a really good question. I mean, when I originally embarked on this research, I had the hypothesis that individuals who had greater psychiatric comorbidity, such as depression or anxiety, would be in the steeper trajectory use group, and then the chippers, the moderate smokers, would have less depressive distress, and so we'll be able to look at that. But in terms of other factors, involvement in the community might play a role. Also, the traditional factors like genetic predisposition to nicotine dependence. I don't know how that's related to sexual orientation. Probably not, but
no.
But that would distinguish those who end up in the high trajectory versus
right,
the low trajectory, though.
Low
yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much. I'd like to remind you we have one more presentation. This is going to be with Dr. Fisher. And I'd also like to remind you that nothing specifically on the schedule happens at 10 o'clock, so please stay for the entire duration, the 18 minutes of Dr. Fisher's presentation. Thank you very much.